We would like to take a moment to thank our sponsor, Preborn. When a mother meets her baby on an ultrasound and hears their heartbeat, it's a divine connection, and the majority of the time, she will choose life. But she can't do it without our help. Preborn needs us, the pro-life community, to come alongside her. One ultrasound is just $28. To donate, dial #250 and say the keyword baby, or visit preborn.com.
Jenna Ellis in the morning on American Family Radio.
I love talking about the things of God because of truth and the biblical worldview. The U.S. Constitution obligates our government to preserve and protect the rights that our founders recognize come from God, our Creator, not our government. I believe that Scripture in the Bible is very clear that God is the one that raised up each of you, and God has allowed us to be brought here to this specific moment in time.
This is Jenna Ellis in the morning.
Good morning. Good morning. It is Thursday, February 6th, and a lot going on, as always, it seems like, in this, the third week of the Trump administration. And President Trump had two very bold proposals during his series of meetings with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. So this coming from The Hill, President Trump on Tuesday suggested Palestinians should be permanently relocated out of the Gaza Strip and that the United States should take over the territory after it was reduced to rubble by more than 15 months of the war between Israel and Hamas. Trump, who was alongside Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu during a White House visit, doubled down on his suggestion that neighboring Jordan and Egypt take in those from Gaza. But Tuesday was the first time Trump was more clear about Palestinians not returning to their homes in the coastal enclave. Now, the White House has walked that back just a little bit, suggesting that maybe it's more of a temporary relocation because of the dangers posed to anyone in that region. And of course, the memes have gone wild, suggesting that the Gaza Strip Mall is likely in the future, that a potential Mara Gaza with beautiful golden gates like West Palm is in the future. But what is the realistic likelihood of this proposal? I wouldn't necessarily put it past Trump to exceed our wildest expectations. But let's welcome in Josh Hammer, who is a syndicated columnist at Newsweek and with the Article 3 Project, and also the author of the brand new book, which you absolutely should read, Israel and Civilization, The Fate of the Jewish Nation and the Destiny of the West. So good morning, Josh. And this sounds very Trumpian.
Good morning, Jenna. It is quintessential Trumpian. I have to say, this was not on anyone's bingo card. I've been in a lot of conversations with friends, colleagues, my wife's relatives live in Israel. I mean, I've been engaged in a lot of conversations since October 7th about the so-called day after question as to what should happen after the war in Gaza. God willing, at some point will be over and Hamas will be destroyed as a political military institution. And I have to say that at no point in literally any of these conversations, literally a single one that I can recall, was the possibility of the United States taking over ever mentioned. So this truly came out of left field. I don't think a single person expected these words to come out of Trump's mouth. I have to imagine that Bibi Netanyahu himself was probably trying to contain his emotions there on the stage, because I'm sure he had no idea that it was coming, just like no one else in that particular room did. It's very hard to say exactly what Donald Trump has in mind here without knowing more details. There was a rumor that I saw reported that it was Jared Kushner who initially put this idea in his mind. That conversation might not have even been recently, might have been a few months ago, a year ago at some point there. Look, I mean, if you are looking at this from a Trumpian real estate developer perspective, I mean, what he says is correct insofar as you are dealing with 25 miles of beautiful Mediterranean Sea coastline. In fact, when Israel unilaterally withdrew from the Gaza Strip back in 2005, and in retrospect, that was a truly catastrophic position, as many folks actually argued at the time. But when they withdrew, the idea was that the Arabs who lived there would have the opportunity to turn Gaza into a so-called Singapore on the Mediterranean, because it really is gorgeous real estate. And they had all the opportunity in the world to just build a beautiful civilization there. In fact, Jenna, in many ways, since Israel withdrew 20 years ago from Gaza, We've actually seen in real time a miniature version of the so-called quote-unquote two-state solution that many people continue to mindlessly peddle. I mean, that's what Gaza has been. And the results of that miniature so-called two-state solution, of course, have been Hamas jihadism with thousands and thousands and thousands of rockets fired, hundreds and hundreds of miles of subterranean terror tunnels, hostages taken, women raped, babies slaughtered. I mean, that is what the so-called two-state solution looks like. So I think that's how Donald Trump kind of enters the program here, and he's trying to think outside the box. He's trying to shatter outmoded ways of thinking. In some ways, it's similar to the Abraham Accords peace alliances of 2020. So when you think about what Trump working hand-in-hand with Netanyahu, what they jointly accomplished in 2020 in bringing Israel together in a circle of peace with the United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, Morocco, Sudan, they basically inverted 50-plus years of American foreign policy establishment thinking about the Middle East, because think tank people, so-called scholars, magazine pundits, all the usual suspects on both sides of the nominal aisle for a half century or more, the so-called two-state solution cartel, I like to call it in my book and elsewhere. The two-state solution cartel used to argue that only by Israel giving more land for peace, more territorial concessions to its annihilationist, subjugationist foes, only that could then induce the Arab states to make peace with Israel. But Trump and Netanyahu flipped the script on that. They showed that by strengthening Israel, by strengthening America's more moderate Sunni Arab allies, you can then bring peace and ideally force the Palestinians to come to the negotiating table, essentially begging for scraps. I think what you're seeing here in some ways is basically a successor to that. It's kind of just a continuance of that same kind of outside-the-box shatterer of norms. I don't know exactly where this is leading. I definitely have some questions, to put it mildly, there. But, you know, until we know more in the way of detail, I think it's a little premature to judge one way or the other. And certainly Donald Trump, as you know, Jenna, has surprised us before.
Yeah, well, and going back to what you said, Josh Hammer, my special guest this morning, about the rest of his aides probably not being informed about this announcement overall, but specifically that day. There's now a viral photo of Chief of Staff Susie Wiles. The Daily Beast characterized it as shooting daggers at Trump, and her facial expression is, at least, you know, for those of us who have been in the room when Trump would make these announcements that nobody saw coming, which was frankly quite frequent. Really resonated with that. I was like, well, she's now discovering what a lot of us went through in the first term. And that was pretty funny. And you can, listeners can go and look at that photo. But how does this whole plan and potential strategy, Josh, I mean, some people are just saying this is a negotiation tactic and all of that, pair or perhaps is in conflict with the shutdown and basically dismantling of U.S. aid, because we do give a lot of foreign aid to Israel. And if that's rolled back at all, which I don't think is actually likely, we're going to not help Israel. But if that's even rolled back at all, doesn't that ultimately hurt Israel?
Well, believe it or not, Jenna, I actually have a somewhat heterodox stance on the question of U.S. aid to Israel. You know, shameless plug, this is something else that I write about in my forthcoming book, Israel and Civilization, The Fate of the Jewish Nation and the Destiny of the West, out March 18th. You can pre-order it on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, or anywhere. So I've actually taken a somewhat differing approach to the question of U.S. aid for a very long time. Now, it is true that the U.S. and Israel, when they invest together, when they work on defense innovation, we do a lot of very cool things and develop a lot of cool stuff together, for lack of a better description. So the Iron Dome missile defense would be a very good example as to what U.S.-Israeli defense collaboration can look like in bringing tangible, practical, real-world results. Having said that, I do think that there are serious downsides, actually, to both countries, to both the United States and Israel, from this somewhat of a bear hug relationship. So from the United States perspective, I think it's worth noting that when we give aid to Israel, it's true that a lot of that aid ends up coming back here because that aid has strings attached to it. Israel has to spend most of that money back here in the U.S. But specifically, you have to look at where that money is being spent. Specifically, that money that they spend back here is ultimately going to major defense contractors, companies like Boeing, Northrop Grumman. So it ends up being a very kind of swampy beltway, effective taxpayer subsidization of major industrial defense contractors, which makes sense because when you look at these large-scale memoranda of understanding, they're called, when the U.S. agrees to give Israel massive aid over a 10-year program, it's actually usually the defense lobbyists who are usually the biggest people advocating for that, which makes sense from their own bottom line. On the other hand, from Israel's perspective, I think it has the mid to long-term effect of undermining Israel's ability to exist as a Jewish state that ought to defend Jews and to fight its own wars on behalf of itself. Because when you become too dependent on a foreign power, even a benevolent foreign power, even a foreign power that shares our biblical worldview as the United States does, you inevitably lose control of your own sense of destiny. You inevitably lose control of your own sense of sovereignty to an extent. And frankly, I think it ultimately undermines kind of the entire idea of Zionism itself, which is that the Jewish people should have the right to self-determination in their own ancient homeland. And that aid also allows left-wing administrations like the Barack Obama and Joe Biden administrations to consistently threaten to cut off that aid unless Israel agrees to do X, Y, Z things. So we saw that repeatedly during the post-October 7th period when Joe Biden was president there. So I think that both countries will actually stand to benefit in the long run from starting to wind down this particular question of aid there. But you're right that at a bare minimum here in the short term, the other day, Donald Trump looks like he is getting the United States out of UNRWA, which is the Palestinian Arab quote-unquote refugee agency. I say quote-unquote because the key to understanding what UNRWA is they basically call millions and millions of people refugees who are not actual refugees. So they basically, under international law, the definition of a refugee is someone who has been actively displaced by a conflict. But UNRWA thinks of this conflict as being the Israeli War for Independence in 1948. The problem is that you have maybe 15,000 to 20,000 people of those folks who are still alive, maybe. And that's holding aside the fact that the Arabs launched that war to kill the Jews in the first place. So I'm holding aside the morality of calling these people refugees. But there's maybe 15,000 to 20,000. But the way that UNRWA operates, Jenna, is it says that if you are a direct descendant of one of those initial people who were displaced, then you are also, for UNRWA's purposes, a quote-unquote refugee. So the entire idea here is to give generations and generations, millions and millions of people, quote-unquote refugee status in order to try to convince them that they will one day return to Israel, a.k.a. to toss the Jews into the sea and destroy Israel from the river to the sea, as the quote-unquote free Palestine folks like to say. So the entire thing is rotten top to bottom. So Donald Trump was certainly emphatically correct to get us out of that.
Wow. And I think that this just underscores the pro-Israel perspective that Donald Trump had certainly in his first 4 years and that he does have into his next administration. And speaking of just all of this on the world stage, in the last just few minutes I have with you, Josh, your book is coming out in March, as you mentioned. It's titled Israel and Civilization, The Fate of the Jewish Nation and the Destiny of the West. This is so timely with all of this that is going on. We have a, by and large, very dedicated evangelical Christian audience that is very pro-Israel. So talk about what you cover in your book, and for those people who want to support Israel, but you know, maybe they're not as sure about all of the policy back and forth and some of these things, I think this is a really helpful resource.
Yeah, totally. So, you know, once again, I really hope that the listeners here who love the state of Israel, who love the Jewish people, frankly, who just love the Bible, Jenna. I mean, as you and I have discussed, that really is kind of the epicenter of this book, because it's basically a defense of the Judeo-Christian biblical worldview. That truly, if you boil it down, is what the actual book is. I basically argue in the book that what we today call "quote unquote" Western civilization literally begins with God's revelation to the ancient Israelites, with Moses standing there at Mount Sinai. And I kind of just trace many modern legal norms, everything from property law and contract law to the idea of federalism in an American constitutional context. So much of what we today take for granted really does have its legal, moral, and ethical antecedents in Scripture and in the biblical worldview. And I basically argue in this book more pragmatically that Israel is indeed a proxy for Western civilization in so many ways, including but not limited to the fact that it is it is basically the world's initial nation state. When King David united the tribes of Israel in Jerusalem roughly 3,000 years ago or so, that was kind of the beginning of the modern nation state. And back then in antiquity, the nation state was kind of contrasted, you might say, to the Roman Empire model. You had nation, then you have empire. So for those people who cherish independent sovereign nation states, who resist imperialism of any sort, including the European Union, United Nations, Davos, World Economic Forum, including these kind of softer modern 21st century forms of imperialism, you have to defend the nation state, and that really begins with defending Israel. So
this will be a great resource,
Jenna, but it's a good read.
Absolutely. Well, thanks so much, Josh. Really appreciate it. Go order Israel and Civilization. We'll be right back with more.
Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Welcome back. And one of the most welcome headlines that is trending this morning is that Donald Trump is protecting the integrity of women's sports. So Town Hall wrote a piece yesterday that said this afternoon, so that would have been Wednesday afternoon, Trump signed an executive order prohibiting male athletes from competing in women's sports. This includes prohibiting men who think they're women from using women's locker rooms and other facilities. The order, titled the quote, "No Men in Women's Sports," mandates that Title IX be interpreted as prohibiting the participation of transgender girls and women in female sports, or in other words, biological men. This is a far cry from the Biden administration's approach to Title IX. And the social media account End Wokeness, which is actually one of my favorites to follow, said this: before you ask, yes, this is exactly what we voted for. No more men in women's sports. So perhaps this ridiculous era of pretending that men can be women is finally over. But let's welcome in William Bach, who is the former general counsel of the U.S. Anti-Doping Agency and is also representing many female, genuinely actual women athletes, to talk more about this. So good morning, Bill. And this is a huge win, I think, for sanity and common sense.
Good morning, Jenna. It certainly is. 2525 is a day that will live in sports integrity history as the day the United States government finally changed its policy and got down to business in protecting a level playing field, fair competition and safety and bodily privacy in women's locker rooms and protected women in sport.
Yeah, it's a thankful, just again, just return to common sense. I mean, it's insane that we're even having to have this conversation in 2025, but the left has continued to push the boundaries and well beyond rationality and common sense. But Donald Trump also, this coming from Daily Mail, declared war on women's sports and declared that the war is over as he unveils a plan to ban trans athletes from the Olympics. So President Trump also said that he would make moves to ensure that no transgender athletes participate in women's sports at the 2028 Summer Olympics in Los Angeles. So I know that you've previously done a lot of work with the Olympics committees and so forth. And so would this proposal be for all countries that are participating? Is this just about the United States athletes, or what's the proposal to your knowledge?
Great question, Jenna. You know, if you take a look at the fine details of the White House executive order, he actually empowers the Department of Homeland Security to prevent arrivals of athletes that are men posing as women and seeking to compete in the women's category, and specifically mentions the Olympic Games. So I do not think that the United States will allow admission for the games to athletes from other countries that seek to perpetrate fraud upon the sporting public in this.
That is really fascinating, actually. So DHS is basically going to deny entry and bar entry from a transgender athlete. I mean, that's a brilliant move to just say you can't even be here, because as soon as they get here, he may not have as much authority or control over the Olympic Committee, for example. But so let's talk about, you know, the executive order comprehensively. So he signed this yesterday. What impact overall does this have on Title IX and women's sports within the United States?
It's going to be huge. You know, part of it is the force of executive power and the ability of the Department of Education to withhold funding for colleges that do not comply with this policy. So if a college or university that receives federal funding, and that's 99.9% of the colleges and universities in the United States, tries to field an athlete, like happened last year in women's volleyball in the Mountain West Conference, like is happening right now with some universities fielding male competitors in women's sports in track and field, for instance. They're in threat of losing their funding, their federal funding. Tens of millions of dollars are put at risk if this policy is violated. And so this executive order empowers the Department of Education to follow that policy and withhold funding. It also requires the Department of Justice to, with its legal team, to support this policy. So it's an all-in effort to keep men out of women's sports. And in addition, the White House press secretary was very clear in the lead-up to the announcement that President Trump expects the National Collegiate Athletic Association, the NCAA, and the United States Olympic Committee to comply with this policy. And so I would say if those organizations don't comply, they do so at their own peril and financial risk and probably legal and litigation risk.
So how would this policy then, you know, directing the Department of Education not to disperse these types of funding, coexist with Trump's policy to dismantle the Department of Education? Is there any concern that they would have to do some sort of wind down or something else to ensure protecting women's sports if he actually does effectively dismantle the Department of Ed?
Well, the executive order speaks to the federal government as a whole and implements the definitions of men and women, for instance, and the correct interpretation of Title IX that other executive orders that President Trump has already issued state. So if the Department of Education no longer exists, these policies are going to be implemented by the remaining departments. And so some of those functions, for instance, of the Office of Civil Rights in the Department of Education are going to have to be transferred to other governmental offices, likely because federal financing for education is not likely to go away, at least immediately. So so that I don't think that the downsizing or elimination of the Department of Education is going to in any way change this policy.
That's really encouraging. And I'm speaking with William Bach, who is the former general counsel of the U.S. Anti-Doping Agency and an attorney who currently represents some of the women, the actual women who have been challenging the men and women's sports for a few years now. And so what is the status of that litigation and how is that potentially impacted now by this executive order?
Well, we're very excited about the executive order and the potential for the Department of Justice and or attorneys from the Department of Education to take an active role in the litigation. We actually filed a third lawsuit and now represent 33 athletes. And this third lawsuit was filed on February 4th against the Ivy League, Harvard University, the University of Pennsylvania, and the NCAA in relation to Leah Thomas's competition in the Ivy League, the Ivy League championships, and really the scheme by the Ivy League and America's oldest and most storied educational institutions to try to impose this radical gender ideology on America's college sports landscape. The plaintiffs in the lawsuit are Grace Esterbrook, Ellen Holmquist, and Margot Kazurowski. And those three courageous young ladies were teammates of Will Thomas, who was a male swimmer on the University of Pennsylvania swim team, and changed his name to Leah Thomas and declared to the team at a time when he was still dating a young lady on the team, declared that he was transgender and going to compete in subsequent years on the women's team. And this was a devastating and traumatic multi-year experience for these young ladies. They lost opportunities. They were in the locker room with a fully intact male in the women's locker room day after day in swimsuits and showers, and then they lost records, opportunities for, they saw their teammates left out of the Ivy League championships. In fact, Ellen was the last person left off the team for the 2022 Ivy League championships because of this man's decision to that his interest in competing on the women's team was more important than the women's interest. So we've now sued the Ivy League as well, and are excited about the opportunity to have the support of the federal government in these cases. What should happen is that the NCAA should immediately agree to enter into a consent decree in each of these cases where they admit their violations of federal law. And they should change their policy immediately, and that should be signed off on by a federal judge, and frankly, they should pay significant damages to these young women that have been harmed, but they should be under a continuing court order that prohibits them from ever engaging transgender insanity in the future.
Yeah, and I'm speaking with William Bach, who is the former general counsel of the U.S. Anti-Doping Agency, and talking about the new case that he's filed on behalf of these, as you mentioned, very courageous young women. And Fox News reported yesterday that the NCAA president, Charlie Baker, responded to Trump's executive order in a statement saying it provided a, quote, clear national standard. He said that the NCAA Board of Governors would review it and take steps to align the organization's policy in the coming days. The statement said this: the NCAA is an organization made up of 1,100 colleges and universities in all 50 states that collectively enroll more than 530,000 student athletes. The statement said, "We strongly believe that clear, consistent, and uniform eligibility standards would best serve today's student athletes instead of a patchwork of conflicting state laws and court decisions. To that end, President Trump's order provides a clear national standard." So this seems to be forward-thinking, not an acknowledgement of their transgressions in the past and admitting that damages to these young women are absolutely should be required, like you mentioned. But it also seems to really discount that the NCAA could have led the way on this. I mean, they didn't need an executive order to provide a clear standard. They could have done that themselves.
And in fact, it's a total smokescreen, Jenna. And in fact, the NCAA did lead the way. They led the way down the path to transgender insanity in college and high school sports by imposing this policy that has been in place since late 2010, or actually adopted officially by the NCAA in 2011. So for nearly 15 years, the NCAA has aggressively led the way in harming women. And so Charlie Baker's statement is a complete smokescreen in an effort to cover up the past and the long history of transgressions against women, discrimination against women that the NCAA has intentionally, and their DEI department, which continues to exist. These are radical activists that have infiltrated college sport, and it's not enough for them merely to change their policies. They're these same people that came up with this plan to impose this ideology on women throughout sport continue to work at the NCAA, and so you know, we'll in the litigation, we'll believe it when we see it. But we're not backing down because the NCAA has not been the friend of women for 15 years. And to say that they needed guidance at the federal level is absolutely wrong. The guidance came in 1972 in the form of Title IX, which guaranteed equal opportunities for women. And they've been violating that law, federal law, with their policies for a decade and a half, causing tremendous harm to women. So nobody should let the NCAA off the hook. They have been called to the carpet by a strong and decisive action by President Trump. And women across the country are rejoicing by his action, but they needed a champion because the NCAA was their enemy.
Yeah, so well said, and I'm glad that you're not just letting them off the hook. So we will be praying for the success of your litigation and the success ultimately of keeping men out of women's sports and protecting these young ladies as they pursue their dreams in athletics. So Bill Bach, really appreciate your time, and we'll be right back with more here on Jenna Ellis in the Morning. If we have learned anything from the 2024 election, it's how important it is for us to fight, fight, fight. We also learned how desperately the left wants to fight to take babies' lives, which is why every day Preborn Ministries fights for the babies. Preborn's network of clinics are positioned in the highest abortion areas, fighting for mothers deciding between the life and death of their child. Preborn welcomes these women with God's love and offers them a free ultrasound to introduce their precious baby and hear the beautiful heartbeat. This amazing encounter gives her baby a fighting chance, and the majority of the time, she will choose life. So would you join Preborn in the fight for life? One ultrasound is just $28, and $140 will sponsor 5 ultrasounds. Babies are worth fighting for. To donate, dial #250 on your cell phone and say the keyword baby. That's #250 baby. Or you can visit preborn.com/AFR. That's preborn.com/AFR. All gifts are tax deductible, and Preborn has a 4-star charity rating. Fight, fight, fight for the babies.
Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Welcome back. And do you remember Dr. Fauci? Yeah, who got that last-minute pardon from Joe Biden and sought to just escape all accountability for his actions during COVID and even back years prior to that. Well, now over a dozen states are looking for potential Fauci charges despite the blanket Biden pardon. So listeners will recall that even though the pardon is on the federal level, that doesn't control the states. And so South Carolina Attorney General Alan Wilson is leading a 17-state coalition of attorneys general asking Republican congressional leaders whether Anthony Fauci may have violated any state laws not covered by his presidential pardon, according to a Wednesday letter obtained by Daily Caller that exclusively reports. So South Carolina Attorney General Alan Wilson joins us now. Good morning, sir. And this comes as very welcome news, I think, to anyone who just wants simple accountability in government.
Well, absolutely. And first off, thank you for having me on your program. It's great to be with you this morning. Absolutely. I was probably as incensed as any of your listeners would have been when I saw the Biden pardons come down. And I want to remind people, or at least explain to people, that the purpose of this letter to Congress that the 17 attorneys general have signed up is not to signal that we're going to weaponize our respective state investigative bodies to go on a witch hunt after Dr. Fauci or anyone else. What we're signaling to Congress is that if there have been laws violated at the federal level that might be also violations of state law, that we are a resource to hold certain individuals accountable. And I want the American people to know and the people of South Carolina to know that while Biden might be trying to cover up what might be alleged violations of law, that if there is a legal recourse for the states to seek, then we're prepared to seek that recourse with the resources available to us.
And that makes perfect sense. That I think everybody knew, reading between the lines and just reading the executive order, that this was an attempt to shield Dr. Fauci from further investigations and potential charges. And if we are a country of law and order, that's not the purpose of pardons. And even though likely because of the broad sweeping presidential power of the pardon, regardless of whether we disagree with it or not, it is presumptively valid under Article 2 of the U.S. Constitution. But it doesn't bind the states. And so your letter specifically talks about efforts in holding malign actors accountable for their actions arising out of the pandemic. And it goes on to say, although former President Biden attempted to shield potential bad actors like Anthony Fauci, accountability via preemptive pardons, we're confident state laws may provide a means to hold all actors accountable for their misconduct. So this is very different, as you say, Mr. Attorney General, from the attempt to weaponize laws and go after someone just because of their last name or their political affiliation or something like that. This is literally just following the law where it leads.
Absolutely. And it's giving those that are now in power in the federal government access to state resources in a collaborative partnership, meaning that, look, if Dr. Fauci didn't do anything criminal or illegal under our state laws, and there's no need for us to pursue him. But if you, Congress and members of the administration, have access to information that suggests he might have violated some federal law where the states have concurrent jurisdiction and responsibility, then the states are willing to evaluate that course of action and pursue it and prosecute, investigate, or sue to the fullest extent allowed by our state laws.
And we hope that these investigations will move forward. So what is the next step? I mean, does this rely on Congress to provide some information to the states? Will you convene grand jury investigations, or how does this move forward?
So we don't have the ability to compel a lot of the information. Now, obviously, there's freedom of information, but there are things that Congress and the administration can get that are more readily available to them because these are federal bureaucracies and they have oversight authority and responsibility, and they're going to be able to get a hold of final reports and other documentation and evidence as they as they review the last 10 to 12 years of all the things that went on with the NIH and other organizations. Obviously, we all know that Dr. Fauci was less than forthright on gain of function research. That was already been discovered in one of the congressional subcommittees. But it is easier for the federal government to provide the states with that information than it is for the states to go try to hunt for it. So we're asking the federal government to say, if you're interested in us pursuing, a review for potential legal violations, then we're going to need your help in providing that information. We have the vehicle to, review it. You have access to the information. And so this is kind of a partnership, and we're just giving Congress and the Trump administration access to our respective state agencies to potentially seek those legal recourses.
And what would the potential legal recourses look like? I mean, obviously there could be criminal charges, but would there be some other potential civil liability vehicle if it didn't rise to the level of criminal activity? Or is that something else you're potentially contemplating?
Yes, I mean, any and all possibilities are on the table for me. I mean, like, all courses of action are on the table. I mean, there obviously everyone thinks criminal, but there are also civil potential courses of action that the states can pursue on behalf of our citizens. And so these are things that each state will have to evaluate pursuant to their own state laws. The 16 other states that joined the letter with me all have different laws. They all have different authorities and responsibilities, and they have the ability to evaluate. You know, we may get access to information that might be violations of federal law, but we might not be able to act on it. That is a distinct possibility. I would encourage the Congress and the Trump administration to continue with this investigation so that at a minimum, the public can at least see what it was Biden was pardoning. And then, of course, if there is something that we can pursue in state courts, then we will certainly pursue that to the fullest extent of the law. And we're happy to consider that, and we'll vigorously do that.
And that's a really great point. I'm speaking with Attorney General of South Carolina, Alan Wilson, that even just to uncover what exactly happened, even if on the federal level, because of the pardon, there can't be any sort of charges that are brought, that still doesn't prevent and absolutely should it should be encouraged to have some legislative remedies that cover some of these types of actions so that in the future, a pandemic or a health concern shouldn't and can't be weaponized in the way that we all experienced the COVID-19 pandemic. One of the things when I was representing Pastor John MacArthur and Grace Community Church out in California during the COVID pandemic, one of the big things was how the executive branch had totally just the legislative branch rather had just totally delegated their authority in health concerns and emergency orders to the executive branch to just continue doing whatever they wanted without legislative oversight, really into perpetuity. I mean, and some of these things shouldn't happen again so that we don't have the same sorts of damages that occurred, especially to churches who were treated so disparately among the states during COVID, where you saw these big box stores and marijuana dispensaries that stayed open in Los Angeles. But then meanwhile, they're telling churches, no, you got to shut down because your people of faith are singing too close together unnecessarily. So are there any aspects in terms of legislation on the state level in South Carolina or with some of your colleagues who've signed on to this letter that you're aware of to try to mitigate some of those potential issues, particularly in the area of religious freedom?
Well, I mean, in South Carolina, we have a pretty strong religious liberty support group here. I mean, the governor, myself, the state legislature. I mean, every state is different politically and, how far you're willing to go, obviously. I'm not aware of any current legislation in South Carolina, but what I can tell you is that if there ever is another situation like the COVID-19 pandemic, obviously, and we have a health agency, a health department, just like every other state does, making sure that there's political accountability to the people that are put in charge of those type of agencies. So, I mean, at the end of the day, not everything is going to be legislative fixes. Not everything is going to be legal fixes. Sometimes the fix is just the political
accountability that the people have by electing the right people in the positions of power who have oversight over those agencies. In this state, I feel like we have significant oversight, and we have a very watchful General Assembly, and we have a very watchful executive branch. I would certainly be counted as the group of people who would be very much adamantly opposed to any infringement on the religious expression if there ever was another pandemic. One last thing I want to say is that the precedent that Joe Biden set for these preemptive pardons that go back retroactively more than a decade is very dangerous. And another thing I'm hoping will happen is if the states can find information to hold people who did something wrong accountable, or at least keep the heat turned up on them, it would be a disincentive for future presidents. And I'm not even talking about President Trump. I'm talking about 10, 20, 30 years from now. If someone were to be pardoned, the states had to hold them accountable. Hopefully that would be a deterrent to future presidents doing this type of thing.
Yeah, and that kind of accountability is, I think, part of the reason that we have federalism, so that there are still a check and balance even on the wide latitude of discretion that the Constitution provides for presidential pardons. That may be something that, you know, future constitutional amendments could contemplate, but even in the area that you're talking about, to disincentivize it, I think makes a lot of sense. And so in just the last couple of minutes I have with you this morning, Mr. Attorney General, so appreciate your time. Have you heard back from Congress yet? I know this letter was just sent out yesterday, but have there been any conversations with Speaker Johnson or anyone on Capitol Hill? And I see that you've also carbon copied a few other senators, including Rand Paul, who's been a huge advocate for this type of accountability, and also Dr. Jay Bhattacharya, who I'm so excited is in the Trump administration now, or conversations that you can tell us about.
We have not had formal conversations yet. There's been some back channel conversations, you know, preliminary stuff, nothing formal, but I do intend to reach out to them. I want to give these leaders in Congress and in the administration an opportunity to absorb and process the letter, and then we can sit down with a group of AGs and talk about next steps. But the one thing I want the people that are, your listeners to know, and especially the people in my state to know, is that this is all about transparency. This is all about accountability. This is all about letting them know that if there is a course of action to pursue that I have the ability to do, that I'm going to pursue it to the fullest extent of the law, and that we're going to send a message to Washington, D.C., that, you know, pardons don't absolve you or relieve you of responsibility and accountability by the people.
Absolutely, and nor should it. And as I'm reading this list of the other 16 states' attorneys general that have signed on to this, it appears they're all Republican-led states. You know, Ken Paxton of Texas, and thankfully John Gard, who's our current acting attorney general here in the state of Florida, signed on. Jonathan Scarametti, attorney general of Tennessee. I mean, and others. These are all red states. What was the response, or did you have any conversations with any of your Democrat colleagues in other states?
No, honestly, this wasn't something that we felt that our colleagues across the aisle would be interested in. I mean, obviously, there's been a line drawn in the sand. This is primarily red state AGs who have constituencies that are pretty animated by this issue, that they're very concerned. Listen, I would certainly welcome Democratic engagement on this issue. I mean, the constituencies in blue states with blue AGs, they were harmed just as much as red states. The question is there a political will on that side of the aisle to go investigate, or to even, if you do investigate, to act on any actionable information that might require you to prosecute? I don't know that our colleagues across the aisle have the appetite for that at this time.
And isn't it always about political will? Well, we're very thankful to you and the other 16 red state attorneys general for having the political will to do this and to just go where the facts and the evidence show, and look forward to having you back on for an update. So Attorney General of South Carolina, Alan Wilson, thank you so much for your time and dropping by this morning. Really appreciate it.
Thank you. Have a good day.
Thanks. You too. All right. Well, you know, this just underscores, I think, for everybody out there, how important it is, as the Attorney General of South Carolina said, to ensure that we have the right people in the right elected positions who are willing to do the job that we, the American people, hired them to do. This is why elections matter. This is why even in blue states, for the people who are conservative, who care and who were just as damaged about some of the COVID-19 COVID-19 stuff as anybody else. I mean, it wasn't as much as the Democrats would have liked to say, you know, that tall people were more affected than short people, apparently, because when you sat down, remember that, you could take your mask off, but as soon as you stood up, then somehow you were more at risk for COVID and had to mask. I mean, just absurd, absolutely stupid stuff. Everybody was affected. And so to have this along political partisan lines just showcases, I think, how much we need to ensure that in all states across the country, we have good people in these important positions of power that not only have the right worldview and framework of using their power to protect the rights and interests of their constituency, not their own special interests or lobbying or anything else, but also to ensure that they have the political will to stand up and do that. Because a lot of times, you know, we have even red state Republicans that are spineless and they won't stand up and they don't have the political will. That's often, unfortunately, what we see at the federal level. So I'm really excited that these 17 states are actually pursuing this. Hopefully, regardless of what actually happens in terms of potential litigation and criminal charges, anything like that, at least the American people will have some answers, but we also do want accountability. All right, well, that is all for us today here on Jenna Ellis in the Morning. You can always reach me and my team, jenna@afr.net. We'd like to thank our sponsors, including Preborn. Preborn has rescued over 200,000 babies from abortion, and every day their network clinics rescue 200 babies' lives. Will you join Preborn in loving and supporting young moms in crisis? Save a life today. Go to preborn.com.